I want your lover and your secretary working every day of the week. Was at the job when no one else was there, helping you get on your feet. 11 years I sacrificed, and you can leave me at the drop of a dime. Swallowed my fears, stood by your side. I should have left your hands 1,000 times. Well, I'm not gonna cry, I'm not gonna cry, I'm not gonna shed no tears. No, I'm not gonna cry, it's not the time, 'cause you're not worth my tears.
Welcome to Sup Media Reviews, the podcast that never needs spoiler alerts because it takes you back in time to relive the nostalgia of classic TV shows and films that you've probably already seen. I'm your host, Kiara, and each week I'll dive into the archives to bring you my take on movies and TV shows from at least 20 years ago. From cult classics to forgotten gems, I'll review them all and give my honest opinion on their impact and whether or not they still hold up today. Join me as we revisit the iconic characters, memorable moments, and timeless themes that made these shows and films so special. So take a break from adulting and get ready for a trip down memory lane with Sup Media Reviews. Hello, Home Slices. The film we're reviewing today is so chock full of great stuff, this episode had to be divided into two parts. So when you're done with part one, don't forget to listen to part two everywhere you find podcasts. What is up, Home Slices? Thanks so much for tuning into Sup Media Reviews. I'm your host, Kiara, and it is March, Women's History Month. This month, we're reviewing and celebrating women-led movies and shows from different genres. 2 weeks ago, I reviewed Scream from 1996 with a special guest, and last week, I reviewed the 1998 film, The Parent Trap, featuring a young Lindsay Lohan. Both of those episodes are available everywhere you listen to podcasts, so be sure to check them out. This week, I'm stoked to review the amazing 1995 film, Waiting to Exhale, which is based on Terry McMillan's 1992 novel of the same name. The movie features Angela Bassett as Bernadine Harris, Whitney Houston as Savannah Jackson, Loretta Devine as Gloria Matthews, and Layla Rashan as Robin Stokes. Now, this movie is a staple in the Black community, and I needed some help to dissect it, so I called on a new friend of mine, Andrea, and she was happy to be my guest. Say hi, Andrea.
Good day to everybody. So happy to be here. Thank you, Kiara.
Yes, I'm very excited that you are here with us today, and Andrea is particularly qualified for this discussion, so I'm really excited to get into it. Do you want to talk more about your film experience?
Happy to, Kiara. Thank you so much. I have been blessed with film as a huge part of my life since I was very young. Was always a storyteller, had the privilege to go to film school in New York at New York University, where I got into a really deeper level of filmmaking, and spent many decades of my life living in Europe, actually making films with a whole bunch of amazing people, and ended up in Seattle almost 15 years ago. And fortunately, no, about 10 years ago more, landed at the Seattle Black Film Festival, where I stepped to the helm to become the director for a number of years before I landed most recently, end of last year, at SIFF, at Seattle International Film Festival in Seattle, Washington. So swimming in films since about the time I was in diapers, coming up with some funky films because my parents were film lovers and were showing me all kinds of weird stuff a little too young.
Nice. Well, I'm so happy to have someone who is so experienced with film here, because here at Sup Media Reviews, we just talk about how the films make us feel. So it'll be nice to get someone who has more experience here to give us some deeper insights into like the movie magic. So very excited that you're here. Now, before we get into the meat and the potatoes of the episode, I want to promote next week's episode, as it will be the final episode in the Women's History Month series. Next week, I'll be reviewing Daria. So if that was a show you were into back in the day, you definitely want to check it out. So make sure you follow, like, and subscribe on social media and your favorite podcast platforms to be notified when new episodes are released. Now back to our regularly scheduled programming. Here are some fun facts about Waiting to Exhale. During the car burning scene, Angela Bassett's monologue was completely improvised. At first, I was having a hard time believing this because the things that she was saying were very specific But apparently it's like a little known fact. What do you think about that, Andrea?
That is intense. You saw my eyes go wide. That is just another representation of the phenomenal acting prowess of Angela Bassett, period. That's all I got to say.
Yes. As I was watching it this time for the review with that knowledge, like that first time knowledge, I was like, that's crazy.
Somebody heard.
Yes. That is crazy. So the second fun fact is that Forrest Whitaker directed this film. He had previously directed an HBO drama film titled Strapped in 1993, for which he received Best New Director honors at the Toronto Film Festival. Waiting to Exhale, which came out in 1995, marked his directorial debut for a theatrically released film. Now, Andrea, how do you feel about this woman-centered story being directed by a man?
Kiara, I dug and I dug and I dug on the internet. I wanted to get to the root of that, and I was not successful. I was like, why did this come together in this way? You will note, actually, I haven't verified this on IMDb, but I believe this was also his final theatrical film that he directed. It didn't create a career for him. I could not answer that question, but based in 1995, no one would have had a problem with a male directing a woman-led cast. Like, that wouldn't have fazed anybody, I don't believe. And I'd say that that's, you know, maybe one person in a room at some point was like, shouldn't maybe a woman? And they were like, no! Here you go, Forrest. Take it away.
Yes. Yeah, I think that that is crazy. It is crazy. Fortunately, it is a Black man. So, like,
that is true. It could have been like, you know, Steven Spielberg.
And the Color Purple, yeah.
Why?
Yeah, that's a little bit crazy to me. And of course, it puts me in the space of like the what if situation of like, how would the story be different if it were directed by?
I feel a wall. Like, you know, I hadn't thought about this before, but there's like, you feel the actors that kind of get up to a wall, and maybe a female director or female director of color would have helped them into a deeper space of meaning.
Yeah. So yeah, that's quite interesting, particularly in Women's History Month. The final fun fact I have here is Babyface produced the soundtrack for this movie. But according to an interview that I saw years ago, Whitney Houston had the idea of making the soundtrack with only female artists. And so originally Babyface, of course, had his own ideas about what he wanted the soundtrack to be. But like, you have to listen to Whitney Houston. She's like, it needs to be all female artists. And the soundtrack for this movie is probably in my top three soundtracks of all time.
Nice.
And we'll get more into that later.
I love that fact that Whitney was like, I have this idea. Hear me out. And Babyface went, sis, tell me what you got. I have also heard, I shared this with you a minute ago, I listened to hours and hours of podcasts that span the period of pretty soon after the film came out and then over the past decades, a lot of very toxic male reviews of the film, like, woo, folk got torn down, burned up. And a lot of people come to the final conclusion that the film only actually had any kind of staying power merit because of the soundtrack, that the film itself was kind of a bomb, but the soundtrack with Brandy and Whitney and I don't remember who else is on there at this point, but that really kept the film and the legacy of the film afloat because the music is pretty good.
That is quite interesting, because in my own personal experience, again, I was only 5 years old when this movie came out. So just from my experience in watching the film, I love the soundtrack and think it's amazing. I feel like a lot of Black women in particular feel tied to the story as well. So I think that's quite interesting that
male point of view.
Feel, yeah, right. That the staying power is the soundtrack. It's like, okay. There was similar information that I found out when I reviewed Love Jones about how Love Jones had been pulled from the theater. But once the soundtrack gained momentum, they actually put the movie back into theaters. So yeah, don't underestimate the power of good music.
It may carry your film to new places.
Yes. So, Andrea, do you have any additional fun facts to share about this film?
I got a couple for you, and most of them make me snark. First of all, the LA Times called this film a social phenomenon when it came out because it had an all-Black cast. Imagine the times. Yes. And it was also called broadly as an ethnic film for the same reasons, because it had an all-Black cast. Another fun fact, as you may have seen in the film, Troy, one of the boyfriends of Robin, one of my favorite scenes in the film, when he comes up with his leather jacket and they're yelling back and forth on the balcony. Does Troy look familiar? The actor, Mick Lee Williamson, went on to become Bubba Gump in Forrest Gump.
Yep.
Two more last ones. Halle Berry and Robin Givens were also auditioned for the role of Robin. This is in an interview from Ebony that Forest Whitaker gave. But once they locked in Angela Bassett and Whitney, that chemistry didn't work out. So they went ahead with the casting with, I'm skipping her name. I got it lower down.
Layla Rashan.
Thank you. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then I was not familiar with this, but apparently there was a whole social media phenomenon, a meme around, he's a good man, Savannah.
Yes.
And for those of you who know that meme, it is from this film. So
yes.
That's all I got for you.
Yeah. Thank you. There are tons of iconic quotes, and we'll get into pretty much all of them as we go throughout the film. But yes, he's a good man, Savannah is. And there are tons of people who have like recreated the scenes on social media as well. It's just a big part of Black culture. And I think even, Andrea, I know this is your first time watching the film. I feel like you probably had a few light bulb moments of being like, oh, that's where that's from. Or I've maybe heard that before. Or, you know, seen snippets of this scene. You just know this stuff.
It's out there. It's out there.
Yes, yes, just as a part of the Black experience. So listeners, if you want to check out Waiting to Exhale, you can watch it on Hulu as of the recording of this episode. Now, here is the part where we get into our personal connections. Andrea, again, I know you had never seen this movie prior to watching it for the review, but as a first-time watcher, is there anything you'd like to share about your personal connection to this movie?
After I hack up alone, I had heard of this film for decade after decade, never watched it, and as I joined SIFF, Seattle International Film Festival, this past fall, I was charged with the very daunting and anxiety-inducing task of pulling together a list of my 10 favorite films. So no lie. Well, first of all, I'm not really good at superlatives, like the best thing, best actor, best food. So I was like, okay, let me dig through some films that I've been meaning to watch for a little while and see if any of them really blow me away. So I pulled out Waiting to Exhale. I actually borrowed it from the library. We have a phenomenal plug for Seattle Public Library and King County Library System.
Nice.
You can borrow, first of all, there's a ton of content online that you can access digitally, but you can also check out DVDs for free. It's a library. So I pulled out the DVD, gave it a watch, and I was like, okay, definitely not in my top 10 of all time. But it was high time to watch this film, and it is really a time capsule of already the story of these four women and relationships during the 90s and, you know, the state of feminism or the lack thereof at that time. And then the concentric circle out from that of the state of Hollywood. We already talked about why is a man directing this woman-led cast and the fact that it can be, you know, construed as such an ethnic phenomenon, a social phenomenon, because you have a bunch of Black people in a film. So, you know, the personal connection that I've developed in the last months is really connecting more deeply with the history of Hollywood and how far we've come and how it is just beautiful to see we're in a different place, not in an amazing place, but we're in a different place today, still with a long way to go. But I don't think this film would just manifest in the same way today. And that's important to me. That resonates with me.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. So for me and my own personal connection to this movie, I feel like it's a huge part of the Black zeitgeist, particularly for Black women. I do feel like there's a lot of the word hatred comes to mind. But if you're not a Black woman or if you are a Black man, I feel like they have a problem with the way Black men are depicted in this film.
Oh, do and they? I don't want to say they're on that.
Yeah. And so just as a Black woman, I view this as a, or have viewed this over my lifetime as a positive experience, not so much because of like the content, but because of what it means to have this like shared experience with other Black women of like observing some of like these iconic scenes in the movie as these women try to navigate their relationships. It features a lot of actors and artists that we love. It has super quotable moments and it tells the story of these four very different women who are at different stages in their lives and they have relatable, you know, 90s trouble. And, you know, I haven't been on the dating scene in like 10 years. So I don't know how common some of these dating issues are now, but there's nothing new under the sun. So I'm assuming people are still dealing with these same types of issues and relationships now. I've seen this movie so many times. I probably watch it a couple of times a year. Again, some of the scenes are just so iconic. It's ridiculous. I love them so much. And so while this movie focuses a lot on romantic relationships with these ladies, I do love the kind of additional focus on the sisterhood of the main characters and how they're there for each other. And so we get to go through the kind of full range of emotions with these ladies. And like, I'm totally here for it. I just love this movie. Another thing that I remember back in the day, I was watching A Different World. I was too young to watch A Different World when it was like on, but eventually I got to the point where I was watching all the episodes. And this is a crazy moment for me for whatever reason. There's an episode dedicated to this book in A Different World.
I missed
in
that.
One of the later seasons.
Because I watched some Different World and the Cosby Show. That was my whatever Thursday evenings for my entire childhood.
Yeah, I think around the time that the show was probably in its second to last or last season, the book had come out and some of the students spent time actually talking about this book. And I was like, that's crazy that like this book comes out and then a TV show talks about this book because it's happening like in real time. And then eventually the movie comes out. And I was like, this is crazy. I don't know why that's so crazy to me. I don't know that I experienced anything like that before.
I love it. But I feel like it's done across white media insidiously. I can't come up with an example, but I love that I feel it reinforcing the cultural narrative and making the narrative of the film just more real in our world, in our cultural world. So I love that.
Yeah. And finally, again, the soundtrack. Y'all, top three soundtracks in the world. It features only female musicians and includes artists like Aretha Franklin, Patti LaBelle, Chaka Khan, Mary J. Blige, Brandy, TLC, Whitney Houston, SWV, Faith Evans, Toni Braxton, like all the people that we love and more. Andrea, do you have a favorite song on the soundtrack?
Oh, my Lord. Ooh, I'm prepared for that question. But Chaka Khan is going to take it every time. So Chaka Khan.
Yeah. For me, the top three songs that really like stick out to me that I love the most are, of course, Not Gonna Cry by Mary J. Blige. The song is so appropriate for this movie. And then It Hurts Like Hell by Aretha Franklin. I love like the sadness in her voice on the song. And then finally, of course, Chaka Khan's rendition of My Funny Valentine. Love it. So those are like my top three. But again, all of the songs are great. So let us know in the comments, like, what's your favorite song from the soundtrack?
Good call.
Okay. Well, I am excited for us to share our perspectives on this movie. So let's dive in. As the credits begin to roll in the opening scene, we hear a radio DJ on New Year's Eve asking for callers to tell him their New Year's resolutions. And so we hear the four main characters briefly talk about their resolutions. This was a detail that I never paid attention to. I totally disregarded this. But then I remembered, I was like, oh snap. They tell the story of these ladies' lives over the course of a year because we begin and end on a new year. So I was like, there are certain things that are happening that are like linked to time. And I'm like, I never picked up on that. I was just watching the movie. Yeah.
Okay, that's true. This only the second time I watched it twice to get ready to go through it with you. And it's only the second time I was like, oh, it starts on New Year's and it ends on. Okay. It's a whole year of all this stuff going on.
Yeah, it's something about having to watch closely and take notes makes you pay attention in a different way. So there are a lot of things that I hadn't noticed before. So each of them has goals they want to accomplish in some way or another. And the song that's in the background as we open up is Weigh You by Shantae Moore. Love that song. It's a great song. And then we get brief snapshots of the lives of our main characters. We see Whitney Houston's character, Savannah, driving a convertible with the, you know, cliche headscarf through the beautiful desert while she does a voiceover telling us that she is moving to Phoenix because the men in Denver are dead. So that's
a good reason to pick up and move on.
Yes. Secondly, we see Angela Bassett's character, Bernadine or Bernie, with two smallish children. In her voiceover, we hear her going over her to-do list and saying that she cloned herself, but she wouldn't have time for the surgery. So busy stay-at-home mom. Next up, we see Layla Rashawn's character, Robin, who is turning heads as she walks in town. She is a super beautiful woman, and I think she looks a lot like Robin Givens.
Yeah.
Personally, I think when I was younger, I couldn't tell them apart.
Like, is that?
Yes. But in her voiceover, we hear her say that she always picks the wrong men, and she has a weakness for pretty boys with big sticks. And I'm like, that's PG.
We are off to the races.
Yes.
With the double entendres in this film.
Yes. And finally, we see Loretta Devine's character, Gloria, who's walking to her car with groceries. And in her voiceover, she mentions that Tyreek, her son, has decided to hang out with his friends instead of her for New Year's. So she's saying like, oh, we would have more fun if we just sat home watching movies together. So she is a mom who is having trouble letting go.
Quick thing. So all of this little vignettes start going through. The first time I watched the film, I thought she was upset because her man wanted to go spend New Year's with his friends. I miss that it was her son. I don't know how it did, but it seemed to fit in that, you know, everyone is talking about their dynamic with men. And I was like, oh, so yeah, like, I know how that is. Some boyfriend's like, nah, I'm gonna chill with my homies, you know? And then you're like, oh, okay, then I'll just hang out. So yeah, I miss that. And I thought that was interesting, but it speaks to, you know, later on in the film, that she does kind of treat her relationship with her son as the man in her life. So I wasn't too far off track.
Yeah, that's a crazy dynamic. We'll talk about that more.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that more later. So next up, we get like a little more detail on each of the characters. They each kind of have their own little space where we learn more about them, what's going on in their lives. And so first up, we have Savannah. She is getting ready for a blind date. And there's some interesting camera work here. Andrea, do you want to talk about that?
I would love to break it down. Yeah. So I don't know if y'all remember, in the 80s, there was something called glamour shots.
Uh-huh.
And you were supposed to, you know, go to the photo studio and they would get you dolled up and they'd put this little foggy filter over the camera and put little stars. So, you know, even like 5-year-old girls, I remember feeling like, like getting makeup all over. And mm-hmm. I was like, this is kind of weird. But I call these the glamour shots moments. And what I love, it appears that they've put her on like a Lazy Susan. Mm-hmm. You know, that little thing on the table, you can turn the salt and the sugar around to the other side of the table. And so we're kind of slowly going around her body and these really close up shots to show her gorgeous skin. But I would say we have allowed skin to be more flawless back in the 90s, which I'm okay with. Like, everybody is perfectly smooth today, and that's just not realistic. But I love these really slow shots, and we get that repeatedly throughout the film, mm-hmm. mostly with Whitney Houston's character. I feel she's treated in a little bit of a baby doll kind of different way than the other characters as we continually return to these the very, you know, beauty shot close-ups of her either intimacy with other men mm-hmm. or with herself and getting dolled up for various things.
Yeah, I think that that's very interesting. I don't know that I noticed the close-ups being more so focused on Savannah. It's quite interesting.
But I know, did Gloria don't have any close-ups like that.
I don't think so, but there is a close-up of Bernadine. When things
do get Bernadine
tense.
A bit.
Yeah.
Yep.
But I don't think I noticed that. That's a great point. So yeah, from Savannah's voiceover, we learn that she's been praying for a good man to come her way and that her prayers have basically gone unanswered, even though she's gotten more specific over time. She says that men don't listen, they lie, they would prefer to guess what a woman wants, and they're, you know, notoriously bad at guessing. And then she says something really interesting, that men are best at convincing women that they should be desperate, and she's happy that she hasn't fallen for it. And I'm like, she proves to be quite desperate throughout this film.
I'm like, have you not?
Yes.
All right, the proof isn't quite in the pudding, but y'all got another 2 hours, so show me.
Yes. And Savannah is wearing a long black gown with spaghetti straps. She has a very 90s updo. It's like a French roll with like lots of tendrils and curls in front of her face. I love, like you said, this being like a time capsule for even style and fashion. I think it's
very much so.
Yeah, very cute.
There's a couple shoulder pads in there too that I was like, oh.
And so as Savannah's getting ready to leave, she gets a call from her mother and she ignores it. And we'll come back to that later. Next up, we get Bernadine or Bernie. She is getting ready to go to a boring affair, which is a crazy choice of words, with her husband for his workplace. And she clearly doesn't want to go. And so when he's like, oh, like, I'm glad you don't want to go. But she's getting dolled up to accompany her husband there, who's played by Michael Beach. She has long hair down to the middle of her back. And while she's combing it to get ready, her husband, John Sr., drops a bomb on her. He's going to go to the party with another woman so that he can live in his truth, basically.
I just love the words. He's like, I can't think of a better time to tell you this. I was like, really? Like, woman looking beautiful, mm-hmm. probably been at this a good 45 minutes to an hour. Like, maybe an hour ago would have been a slightly better time.
Yes.
But if you couldn't think of a better time, that's all right. And actually, I want to say one thing, too.
Yeah.
Bernie Sanders kind of ruined the name Bernie. Didn't ruin it, but like, Bernie's going to be Bernie Sanders for me. You can't put another, since I only saw this film recently, you can't put another Bernie. It's going to be Bernie Sanders. So I spent part of the film just trying to get Bernie Sanders out of the scenes.
He's too tired. Imagining him at the inauguration with his little mittens.
Exactly.
Nice. Yeah. Bernie being used for a nickname for a woman is odd, I think.
Let's call it unique. We ain't judging. It's unique.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. So, yeah, he's like, he tells her that he's leaving his wife for the woman who keeps his books. And Bernie kind of figured out she already knew what was going on a little bit. So right as Bernie starts processing what her husband says, the radio that's playing in the background does an emergency broadcast test. And
I love this.
Never noticed it before. And I was
that
like,
is
this is looking kind of good. Yeah. Like
filmmaking brilliance of just like, and
yes.
Right at the exact moment in the thing. This is a beautiful moment that just flattens out, creates all this tension.
Mm-hmm.
And it's annoying. You feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. It's just low level in the background as you don't know how their interaction is going to play out. And it just adds so much tension. I love that.
Yeah. Again, never noticed it before, but I was like, oh, this is crazy. This is actually really good. And so Angela Bassett is wearing what appears to be hazel contacts. I hate them. I don't know why. Like, I
detail. I did not see that.
Because it makes her look scary to me. Like, there's something about the intensity of the contacts that really...
Wolf lady kind of glare.
Yeah, right, that bother me. But the scene gives us some iconic lines. But the bottom line is that Bernie's husband of 11 years is leaving her for a white woman that he has been working with. And when he asks her, you know, would it have been better if she were black?
And it would have been better if you were black.
Yes.
Ooh.
And something about Michael Beach's character is low-key, like, maybe sociopath a little bit, because getting a reaction out of him is almost impossible. Like, I can't tell if he's just being, like, a butthole or if this is, like, his personality.
You literally do not have emotions. Like, that part yes. of your brain did not develop.
She, of course, is upset, and understandably so. And he's like, thanks for making this easier for me. And it's like, who are you? What is happening?
And his feeling it sufficient to say, it's okay, you can have the house and I'll be present for the kids. Like, I love the kids, so I'll take care of them. Like, oh, so everything's okay. Right. So fun. Yeah, go ahead and leave me. It's good. I get a house and you love your kids. Cool.
Right. And it's like, okay. And then he says, I'll be back next week for my things. So you're not going to be a dad for a week? Like, you're just
how
not
does this work? Apparently planned this out to an extent.
Yes.
I get the house, you'll be back in a week, and you love your children, okay?
Yes. It's so strange. Once John Sr. leaves the room, the emergency broadcast message is over. Yeah. Crazy scene. Literally the first few minutes of the movie. That's nuts.
A lot happened there.
Yes.
Which is why we had the radio test to just kind of settle in and take it in, I guess.
Yes. So next up, we see Robin. Robin is at her apartment with her dog, a very cute dog. And she is upset that she is spending New Year's alone and complaining about a lying, cheating man that she was dating named Russell. We meet Russell later on. This is all we get of Robin for now.
I do want to point out her wardrobe when she's on the home court at her house. There was no Lululemon yet, but she has a wild array of aerobic, mm-hmm. form-fitting, sports bra and tights kind of thing. So the scene with Troy later on, she's up on her balcony with this little, like, are you always ready to jog?
Yeah, she's always ready, yes. But she does appear to be a bit younger than the rest of the ladies as well.
We do pick up on that early in the film, in the first scenes. Yep.
Yeah. And then finally, we have our snippet of Gloria. We still hear the radio DJ in the background who's playing songs from the soundtrack of the movie. And when we transition over to Gloria, she is at home with her 17-year-old son, Tyreek, and she's fixing a plate of food. Her son seems really anxious to leave for the New Year's festivities. Like, she's kind of holding him there. They seem to be in this stage in their relationship where they are in constant disagreement. Tyreek, the son, wants more freedom and to be able to do things on his own, while Gloria wants to, like, cherish the time that she has left with him and is still being a little clingy and authoritative. And we learn a few things about their dynamic. Gloria's ex, who is Tyreek's father, is coming into town next week, and Tyreek is like, so what? Like, I don't see him very often.
I see this dude every 2-3 years, so yes. Am I supposed to care?
Yes. And we also learn that he only comes into town every couple of years. They don't have much of a relationship. But Gloria routinely sleeps with Tyreek's dad whenever he is in town. And so Gloria gets upset when Tyreek throws that in her face. So that's not nice. Andrea, what do you think we're supposed to get and understand about these ladies from these first kind of opening scenes where we learn about their lives?
One thing I love is first of all, there is a lot of information because we are still 5 minutes or less into the film, I want to say, maybe 10 minutes of a 2-hour film. So a lot of information changes hands, particularly around the world of Bernie. But for me, what strikes me most is the dynamic. There's a lot of camera movement. We're editing from one vignette to the next and one story to the next. I want to say funky. I had to come to terms with it. The use of voiceover of the mm-hmm. woman telling about their story and intercutting that with the sound from the actual scenes on screen. So a lot of dynamic, a lot of information. I get a mover shaker vibe from these women. They're trying to put it out there like these are, you know, not women who are settled, you know, resting on their laurels. There's stuff going on for them. And they have a lot of passion, a lot of desires, and a lot of things that they're trying to do or are doing. So I appreciate more so just the overall tone that the film is setting for what mm-hmm. you're going to see.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. And also, I think it also highlights the differences between the women. We have a woman who is married and who is about to go through a separation. We have a single mother who's almost raised her child to their adulthood. We have Savannah and Robin, who are different in ages, but and in different stages in their career, and they are childless. And so we get to see the differences between these women and where they are in their lives as well. So yeah, I love these characters. And they are all so beautiful. Like,
yeah,
we love them.
You said one thing earlier, and I'm going to lose what it was, but really speaking to what you just said, the breadth and scope of the Black female existence, mm-hmm. like this film busts open a monolith. And I think just ways that weren't seen on screen before, that yeah. a Black woman is not just a single mother. Mm-hmm. I think in the 80s and 90s, that is an image that a lot of people will come to mind. It's either she's, you know, a young woman who's out tramping, or she's a single parent. Mm-hmm. And that's just a one-dimensional view of what a Black woman is. So already setting up the film with four Black women in very different stations in life, in different phases of their life, mm-hmm. and just in very different domestic situations or personal situations is wonderful. That, yeah, we're not a monolith. Thank you.
Right. Yes. I think that's a really great point. I enjoy that we get to see a larger view of who we are and what we can be and what we deal with. So I think that's an excellent point. So let's move on to Savannah's date. Savannah, again, you know, earlier was getting ready for a blind date. She goes to a club called the Hermosa. Hermosa is beautiful, I think is what it means.
Ah, I don't know.
I actually do not remember, but the DJ is actually broadcasting live from this club at the party. There's a New Year's party going down. We hear Sitting Up in My Room by Brandy playing in the background. And Savannah briefly sits at a table, and the other women are quite mean to her.
But the setup is weird. I have a problem with this scene. Like, she's on a blind date, so she shows up at this place. Mm-hmm. And in her voiceover, she's like, and, you know, men, look out tonight because, you know, I'm on a course for, you know, I'm out to kill or something like that. And she walks up to this table. And of course, there's all the, like, she does not know these people. So she's like, do y'all mind if I sit here? And the dudes are like, you know, in these funky turtlenecks and mustaches. I love the fashion here. And the guys are like, I guess so. And the women are just ice daggers in the eyes. Mm-hmm. Like, who is this pretty lady coming sitting down next to my men? And I was like, why is she doing that? She's supposed to meet somebody. So, yeah, it was weird, kind of weird.
Yeah, but it was a little strange. I also felt like, what kind of place was this? Because it was supposed to be like a club, but it came across more like a large lobby or like maybe even a house. Like, I don't know, the setup.
The location scouting was a little off.
Yes, it was weird. Yes.
I was trying to make the analogy in my mind, like, is this a sit down place where people booked mm-hmm. $200 a head for their New Year's thing? My mind kind of went there too, like, what is happening here?
Yeah. Who knows? But eventually, her blind date meets her. His name is Lionel, or Lionel, I don't know. But Lionel is played by Jeffrey D. Sams, and you might remember him from Soul Food. You also might remember Michael Beach from Soul Food as well. And there's actually a third character in this movie who was also in Soul Food. So the child who is Bernadine's oldest child, the son, is actually like the main character in Soul Food. So there are a number of people from this film that went on to be in Soul Food, which came out, I believe, a couple years later. So with lots of connections. The two of them dance, Savannah and Lionel, and it's actually a really lovely kind of romantic scene.
It's gorgeous. This is, yes. again, back to the same kind of close-ups of Whitney mm-hmm. at the beginning of the film. You get these gorgeous, delicate, almost glamour shots, a little, you know, hazy of mm-hmm. putting their arms around each other mm-hmm. and going in, you know, doing their slow dance. It's really delicate. I appreciate the delicate intimacy. Again, not often associated generally with Blackness. So yeah. You know, thank you for putting that on the screen.
Yeah, I appreciate that as well. And it's very romantic. The song that's playing in the background is called I'm Gonna Make You My Wife by The Whispers. And in the voiceover, we hear Savannah say that she decided to exhale. I think it's actually the only reference to exhaling that we get in this movie. And basically what she was saying is that in this moment, things feel perfect. And I'm gonna pretend that Lionel is the one.
And sometimes you gotta do it. I was like, yes, sis, because, you know, sometimes it is what it is. And part yes. of making it what it is you believe in very strongly that it is what you want it to be. So the yes. mental power of the mind.
Yes, yes. Fake it till you make it. And things were going well until then, a woman...
Dude's wife literally walks up.
Oh, I don't know that it was his wife.
That's the thing. I assumed it was his wife. And I was like, why are you on a blind date and your wife walks up? What is happening? So yeah, straighten that out for me. Because I was like, how did this situation come together?
The way it looks to me is that Lionel invited at least two ladies to meet him at this party. Denise was one of them, and she came up to say, like, you haven't danced with me all night. Now, you may recognize the woman playing Denise. Her name is Kenya Moore, and she has been on Real Housewives of Atlanta for probably like 10 years now. She also won, it was either Miss USA or Miss America back in like the early 90s.
Oh, wow.
And so she pops up here and there and does cameos in a number of very Black-centered things over the 90s.
Nice. Wife or not, that was just inappropriate. I'm like, dude, why are you stacking multiple? You don't go to New Year's Eve with multiple people.
Yes. It's not appropriate. Yes. And so Savannah leaves the party alone. She basically doesn't say anything. She just kind of walks away. And I'm like, girl, yeah, there's no
Peace
use.
Out. And
no use in getting into it. And so next up, we see Gloria, who owns a beauty salon. So we have a Black entrepreneur. And it appears that the name of the salon is called The Oasis. And she's there with her staff of a number of hairstylists. And Robin is in there on her lunch break painting her own nails for free. Gloria is annoyed by this. But one of the hairstylists is a gay man named Joseph, who's being played by Lamont Johnson. Now, I feel like this depiction of a gay hairstylist is a trope in a number of Black movies.
I was a little disappointed.
To me, it's problematic, yes. And it's one of the things about this movie that it doesn't really hold up.
And he gossip. He's just gossip. Like, yeah.
Yes, yes. He's gossiping. He is a one-dimensional character that's treated more like an accessory than like an actual character. It comes up in other movies as well. So yeah, I find this to be problematic. But Joseph's role in this particular scene is to tell Robin and Gloria that John left Bernie for a white girl. This is news that they had not heard before. Apparently, Joseph ran into Bernie looking a mess at the Circle K, and that's how he got the scoop.
That's why we have beauty shops and barbershops, because how else are we supposed to get the news?
Yes. Are you at all surprised about the number of Black people in the Black community in Phoenix just from this film?
That was my first of all, the film opening with a Black woman driving through the desert, like the film opens that way, and I was like, wow, already I'm struck. We're putting Black people like not in the ghetto.
Yeah.
We in the desert too, and the whole film takes place in Arizona, and I was like, wow, we were out there. They got Black people in Arizona. So yeah, that throughout the film, I'm just baffled on a rolling basis that there's a Black community. And they, you know, another note, they're out and about. Like, they have these little dates. They're at the swimming pool. They're at the rodeo. They're at the cafe. Like, they're out and living. And I'm like, all right, I got to check out Arizona because apparently it's popping.
Yeah. My husband and I were actually just there. And I don't know that I noticed a lot of Black people, but I probably just wasn't where they hang out because we were vacationing and doing other stuff. But yeah, we out here. We everywhere. So that was nice to see.
Definitely.
Yes. So
again, breadth and depth of the Black experience. We are not just in the ghettos of New York City on welfare. We live in Arizona and drive top-down cars through the desert. Thank you very much.
Yes. So Gloria and Robin call Bernie and leave a message for her, you know, when they hear this news. Robin is more upset than anything. And he's like, how dare he leave you with two kids?
She just picked the phone out and she's like, oh my God!
And Gloria seems to be like more level-headed. She's, you know, older, a little more mature, and is more so focused on like the supportive element. Like, hey, call us, you know. And Robin is like, how dare he?
That is the wisdom of Gloria's age.
Yes, yes. Okay. So in the next scene, we get the mega iconic scene.
It's on. I couldn't wait. This is it. Yes. This is why we all come to this film.
Yes. So back at Bernie's, she is still wearing the outfit that she was going to wear to the event with her husband. So
I did not catch that detail. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. She hasn't changed clothes. She hasn't really done much to take care of herself. She is still in the shock.
Waking up with that love hangover.
Mm-hmm. What happened? So I can't tell how much time has passed, but she's clearly kind of out of it. She listens to the messages from her friends as she starts her day and even hugs their kids as they get on the bus, despite being a hot ass mess. Like, she's still out here doing what she got
to
do.
That is exactly. That is just a point to all the moms in the world, because it's rough sometimes and your kids don't need all that. So your ability to shield your children from the reality of the world wears you down. But I appreciate that scene where she's just keeping it together for the babies. And she does throughout the film. They're in a couple scenes here and there, but she's just cool as a cucumber. I love her.
Yes, even though she's like taking the kids to the bus with no shoes on and her hair looking a mess, she's like, y'all give me a hug.
Have a great day. I love y'all.
And have a good day. Yes. So When Bernie is alone and the kids are off to school, we get the most iconic and I think highly debated scenes in the Black community, okay? She enters her husband's very large closet that is organized to a T. And she begins to do this monologue, which again, apparently was improvised.
Oh, that one too. I love that. Oh, that monologue. I've been in that dark place. All kinds of angry, and I know exactly why. And I'll tell you about it.
Right. And she starts removing his items from his closet angrily and taking them out to the garage by like the wagon load. And as she's doing this, we are learning additional details about their relationship, because she is just angrily talking about them. All of these things are red flags and are quite awful. We find out that Bernie has a master's degree in business and forewent building her own catering business to help her husband with his startup. She was his office manager and secretary, and she obviously was overqualified. She uses this phrase that he apparently told her where he says, "I need you to be the background to my foreground." And so
that burns so deeply. And I just, that line speaks so much to me because I think it reverberates through the experience of like millions of women around the world. That is the reality. And just a, you know, in a totally expected and blasé way, like this is what men expect of the women in their lives.
Yes.
Not okay.
Yeah, not at all. I do feel some rage hearing that. Hearing that phrase. We also learned that her husband was counting the number of times that they were intimate with each other.
That was weird.
Which is very weird. And this is why I'm saying that her improvising this is sounds crazy to me, because these are crazy details.
I mean, to me, again, that just goes to Angela Bassett as an actor. Because to me, an actor, your director and the script are going to put certain things on the table. And you have to make sense of that as an actor and go deep and connect with parts of yourself that you can put on the screen that express that character, excuse me, and that character's experience. And like, that does not faze me. I'm just super impressed, but it doesn't faze me that, yeah, she could pull that out. They were like, this is your situation. This is what he has done to you. This is what you had to sacrifice. And she's like, oh, I got you. Yep. Give me two minutes. All right. Action.
Yeah. This is crazy. She even says the number. She's like 732. That's the, you know, amount of times that they were intimate, and that she regrets not leaving him when he told her that he was counting after the 51st time. And it's like, this man is weird.
Whoa. I do see a correlation between him counting the number of times they were intimate and the state of his closet and the ordered, you know, aspect of his clothing and belongings.
She even said that they're probably serial killers who are less anal. And I feel like that also plays into his demeanor about the way that he comes across as like emotionless as well. But Bernie says that the worst offense, though, from John is that he sent the kids to a school that only has two other Black kids because he didn't want their children to be improperly influenced. And then Bernie is like, you are the improper influence.
A whole bunch of stuff like, been unsaid in that relationship.
Yes. And so she's like, get your stuff and get out. And so after she loads up the car with his clothes and his shoes and all the stuff that's in the closet that she can fit into this car, she uses lighter fluid and a match to burn it up while she smokes a cigarette. And she, it's one of those things where I feel like she's happy with herself, but it's not enough.
I feel like there's a level of healing in doing this. I wouldn't say it reaches happiness, but there's satisfaction. There's some healing and some satisfaction, but I agree it is not enough. It is a drop in the bucket. We are just getting started. Hence the yard sale scene a little later on. Spoiler.
Yes. We get a brief shot of John's now empty closet. Now, overall, I really love this scene. It captures this kind of righteous anger, years of feeling unappreciated and having to sacrifice so much to be supportive to a man who truly didn't love her and ended up leaving her. I can feel all the rage. And even though what she did is quite dangerous.
A little on the edge, but yeah.
You know, a little illegal maybe. I felt good watching it burn with her. I was like, yeah, girl, burn it up.
That
like,
satisfaction was there.
Yes, totally. Yes. Bernadine, more like burn it down. I'm kidding.
I will note that I shared with you that I listened to a number of podcasts about this film already to kind of fill my head up with some stuff. And many of them hosted by men. And the men do not accept this scene. Oh, they reject it. The acting is terrible. And how dare she? And I'm like, y'all, therein lies the problem. Y'all don't get it.
Yes.
Case in point. Thank you. Thank you for making this easy for me, as he said.
Yes. Yes, it's highly debated. I personally love this scene. She captures all of those feelings. And again, improvised, that's freaking crazy.
That rage is so real. Beautiful.
Yes. But later, the fire department shows up to the house and they're like, oh, you can only burn trash in your car. And she's like, it is trash.
It starts with, are you aware that your car is on fire, ma'am? And first of all, I had a little Arizona moment. I'm like, policemen show up at the door, black lady answers it, and there's a burning car in front of the house. They will not be an even keel. Are you aware that your car is on fire, man? Be like, get down on the floor! So I was like, I struggled with the realism. I love the dialogue in that scene, but I was like, really? They're going to be all calm? I guess she's in a really rich neighborhood.
Yeah. And he mentions that. And that I was like, hint of racism, where he's like, oh, this is a nice neighborhood. And like, don't bring that hood mess over here.
Burning cars and shit up in here. Mm.
Right. Knowing that as a firefighter, he probably can't afford to even live in that neighborhood. So like, mind your business.
Thank you for judging me.
Yes. And Bernie says, okay, like it won't happen again. And basically close the door in his face.
I'm done here. Like, have a nice day.
Yeah. Yeah. Mind your business. This next scene is so weird to me.
I struggled. My brain went for, I struggle. And then I had to confront my struggle in a later scene that's very similar. Mm-hmm. With Whitney Houston's character, but I struggle with comedic sex scenes, and it immediately brought me back to the boomerang scene with the feet, like Eddie Murphy, and like he pulls up the sheets and he sees this woman's feet and he's like, oh, and like they're all trying just like silly sex scenes. I tend to struggle, and then it just gets weirder and weirder with their dialogue at the very end. So let me let you break it down, because there was a lot of awkwardness in this scene.
Yes. So Robin's in her apartment with a kind of, you know, hefty little short man named Michael, who was just promoted to her marketing team. Robin is not attracted to this guy, and she even says some mean things about him in his voiceover. And I'm like, girl, why is he here?
Right. Why are you in bed about to sleep with him? If you, shade is present.
Yes. But Michael is available. That was her, you know, excuse. And it's like, girl, you're beautiful. There's tons
My top three things with men is that they be available, that they speak English. You know, no, come on. We can just.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I was like, girl, okay. Michael isn't particularly smooth or suave. And this whole scene is awkward and it's almost cringeworthy for me.
Oh, I cringed.
It approaches that area. Yeah.
I cringed. Particularly when it gets to the dialogue.
Yeah. There's a point where he throws her on the bed, which is hilarious. That was very funny to me. As they prepare to engage in adult activities, Robin finds herself having to initiate things like, should you undress me? You know, you better wear this protection, which I'm glad that they're depicting.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I did not catch the nuance of that. At least we are using protection. Thank you. Yeah.
Yes.
In the 90s, likely not showing up in every film.
Yes. So yeah, they're depicting safe sex, which is great. And in her voiceover, we hear her say that Michael has expensive hobbies and a boat in the White Mountains. I don't know where the White Mountains are, but I'm assuming this is something that has attracted her to him as well. And I feel a little suspicious about Michael's tales of his wealth and what he has. If he was recently promoted to Robin's team, I don't see him having that amount of wealth.
Point. Yeah.
I feel Legion vibes. And I don't know if you know what I'm talking about. A woman recently went viral. Her name was Risa Tisa on TikTok for doing a 50-part series on how she was married to a pathological liar.
Whoa.
And it went viral. And in the story, he tells a bunch of lies. And I was like, I feel like he's lying about his wealth in a similar way.
Is it because he's black?
But
he
anyways,
could be a golden child,
Robin,
you know?
Says that
he could have come into
He could. He actually could come from some wealth. You are totally right. I am very suspicious, though.
I remain suspicious. I'm just suspicious. I remain suspicious.
Yes. So Robin is like, oh, I told him that I was, you know, an army brat and I went to this university, whatever, whatever. Long story short, they get into their adult activities and it is just ridiculous and clunky and clumsy. And Robin is just laying there. And even though she is not impressed with Michael's size or performance, she goes along to get along and strokes his ego in a way that is dishonest and undeserved.
And she even says at a point, she's like, and I felt young and sexy and beautiful and everything was perfect for once. And that's like, nothing is perfect.
Girl, why?
Yeah, and I was like, everything is perfect because you gave up your wish for a sexy dude and settled for Michael? Like, that's all I'm getting out of this scene, is you're just, you know, settling for less because he's available.
Yeah, there's an additional part that happens before she mentions all that stuff where his endurance isn't good. He doesn't last very long. Robin hated this interaction. And once they are laying in bed afterwards, Michael asks her how she feels and he can tell something in her energy
that is so funny.
Off. And so Michael's like, well, tell me what you want and I'll make sure you have it. And so Robin warms up and she's like, I want a house in Scottsdale. And he's like, I got one of those. And she's like, I want to get married. I want to have 2 or 3 kids. I want to eat out 2 or 3 times a week. I want to go on vacation, have a family. I want to be happy. And Michael's like, I can give you all of that and more. And so Robin asks Michael, what does he want? And he's like, I think I found it. And I'm like, oh, maybe he is more of a sweet talker.
I kind of, at that little moment, I had a little, maybe it was naive. I was like, you know, maybe this is sweet. You know, and it isn't, even if he's not a great sexual performer, it's still kind of sweet. And this could, you know, we can get along around simple desires in life. But then I was like, no. If I can give you everything you want and everything you need, if you let me, says Michael. And I was like, are you serious? I'm sorry, what?
Yeah, Robin kind of falls for it. She's in that moment where she's just like, oh, that sounds wonderful. And so from the way it sounds, they try again. And Robin changes her tune. And she's like, you know, kiss me, but don't be rough about it. And she's like, I feel young and sexy. And she's like, with the right amount of delusions and pelvic exercises, everything felt right.
You're like, that's true.
So, yeah, that scene is so weird. And throughout this movie, all of the women compromise or have compromised in a way that just is not healthy.
That is a heavy theme for me throughout the film, that like the women find happiness by giving up what they really want. Granted, in a lot of situations, it's like, is that what you really want?
Right. Yeah.
But still, it's like, yeah, if you want to be happy, you just have to stop wanting what you want and settle.
Yeah. And focus on someone else's happiness.
Yep.
So, yeah. But in the next scene, Savannah shows up to Bernie's house. They get a drink while they're there. And Bernie is watching a home video of her and John at a party for one of their anniversaries.
Yes, on the big old screen on the background of him hugging her and kissing her back in the day. Ouch.
Yeah. Bernie says that she always thought that if she gave John what he needed, that he would give her what she needed. And there
that
was
one
no
of the most
real...
powerful lines in that, like one of the epic lines in the film that I think, again, resonates with a whole bunch of women, like 10, 15, 20 years into a relationship. You're like, I've been trying so hard, but you weren't actually.
Yeah.
It was just me.
Yeah, and there's no reciprocity. She also says that it's amazing what can happen when you give a man control over your life. And she even takes some accountability for her own kind of complicity in their relationship.
That's true. That's powerful that she said that out loud. Yeah.
Yeah. But Bernie switches the subject to Savannah's new job. Savannah apparently took a pay cut to see if she could be a producer. And she's trying to live her dreams. So... yeah. In the backyard of Bernie's house, they have a picturesque backyard. There's a pool.
I love that scene. There's the perfect desert sunset in the background.
Yes.
Bernie's hair looks perfect. We're living a good life.
Yes. And it's actually quite beautiful. And both Bernie and Savannah admit to being scared, you know, scared in their own ways. But it's nice to see this level of friendship, because there's also a myth that women don't support each other and that they're catty. And while that does exist, it is nice to see.
It is not the norm,
I would say.
Friendships.
Yeah.
Right? Again, with just the depth and dimension of the representation of the Black female experience, this is one of those scenes. It's like, yeah, every day, just an everyday scene of two women supporting each other and connecting. There's a whole lot of drama. It's a little bit loaded. But yeah, just connecting and not, you know, being in the ghetto, getting drunk, raising babies as single mothers.
Yeah. Exactly. And so next up, we're at Gloria's house. This scene is also like a little
another weird one
for me.
What happening there? There were multiple times I was like, did I just hear what I think I heard? Is that like, okay, so last time what? So break it down, Kiara.
Yes. So at Gloria's house, her ex David, who's played by Giancarlo Esposito, who I love, he stops by the house and we hear Gloria's voiceover say that the last time David visited, he did her a favor by spending the night and she's hoping that he'll be merciful again tonight.
Merciful.
And I'm like, girl, your self-esteem is in the Mariana Trench. Like,
pretty low.
Yes. She's awkward with him as Patti LaBelle's My Love, Sweet Love plays in the background. And David is there to see his son, his biannual visit to see his 17-year-old son.
It's son o'clock.
Yes. And so Tyreek isn't home. And David's like, I don't know why I keep doing this. He's almost grown, right? And so when Gloria reveals that Tyreek actually won't be home until tomorrow, David gets up to leave. He's over it, right? They are quite awkward with each other. And Gloria's energy is reeking of desperation. He's like, yeah, let me get up out of here.
Desperation and awkwardness. I feel terrible for her. She's in her home.
Yes.
And she doesn't seem well at all with him in her home, like in her whole situation. Like it's really, it's a bit hard to watch.
Yes, I agree. And so Gloria tries to get him to spend the night with her like last time. And he reveals that he's been bisexual for years and now identifies as gay. And Gloria is like, you don't have to lie to me if you don't want to sleep with me. And he's like, I'm not lying. Like, this is right. who I am. And so this is a different depiction of a gay man in this story that is very separate and a little bit more two-dimensional than Joseph that we saw earlier. But yeah, David,
I had to dig a little bit, and I was curious if, I don't know, I unpacked probably a bit too much here. I was like, wow, is bisexual a story that he was telling himself or other people because of the lack of acceptance? Like, you know, gay would be the worst thing on the earth, so bisexual might be a little bit more acceptable or safe for him. Mm-hmm. So I had plenty of thoughts around that of like, no, he's probably been gay all along, but
yeah,
there was just not a lot of space for him to do that for himself.
Yeah. I agree. In 1995. And then also to not do it in the way that Joseph was doing it in this tropey, right, kind of way.
Like, so, I'm just a gay dude. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just living my life. Yeah. And then David says something that actually annoys the bejesus out of me, where he says that if Tyreek wants to see him, that Tyreek will have to make the first move. And that if he doesn't hear from his son by noon the following day, he's going to check out of his hotel. And I'm like, okay, so.
What is that coming from? Yeah.
Like. A deadbeat, kind of like.
Yeah, deadbeat and then putting the onus on you. The clock's ticking.
Right.
If you want me to be in your life 2 years from now again, yes. You better show up before noon tomorrow.
Right. And I was like, ugh, this is gross. Like,
yeah.
What's wrong with you?
No thanks, Dad.
Yeah. But Gloria is left and she can't be feeling good.
No. I think if there was an end to a story, I think that she arrived at it in that evening in her home
yeah.
with her ex.
Yeah. Yeah, she doesn't have that to fall back on every couple of years. So next up, we see a brief scene. It's a garage sale where Bernie is saying that everything must go. And she is selling the stuff that wasn't burned up of John's.
Everything's a dollar.
Yes, things that survived the fire. And she's literally selling stuff for $1. She is really happy doing this. Like, she has a smile on her face. She doesn't care that the kids are arguing and tearing stuff up. She's like, it's
she's
almost
in the special,
like
yeah.
A tad delirious, like it's
that's
almost
how I read
reaching.
It. I was like, yes. ooh, don't. Yes. Yeah, if anything were to cross her during that yard sale, like portions of the neighborhood might have gone up in smoke. So which, you know, when the kids are fighting and they break something, she's like, it's all right. We are all good. Just she is in a special place, in that probably very fragile place. But again, her performance in that scene is on point.
Yes. Also, Not Gonna Cry by Mary J. Blige plays in the background. Of course, love that song. Mary J. Blige is awesome. Next up, we see Savannah. She's at her house. Another weird scene where Chaka Khan's My Funny Valentine plays in the background. Love her version of the song. And we're at Savannah's house where she is entertaining Lionel, the lying blind date from earlier in the movie. Now, from Savannah's voiceover, we learn more about this man. And the more we learn, the less likable he is. This man is using her toothbrush. Gross. Has no real income, smokes reefer as
reefer. Is that the word she used? I didn't pick that up. I love it.
Yes.
Reefer.
And he lies about being a vegetarian. She had to give him gas money at some point. And like, okay, this is where I was like, I had to do some research. She gave him a $20 bill to get gas. The gas came to $7.18. And she's like, he didn't even give me my change. And I was like, forget the change.
How did you pay
$7?
So I started to drive in 1995. Fun fact.
Okay.
I got my license and I remember gas prices hovering in the $1.50 range.
Where were you at this time?
In the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area.
Okay. So I looked it up and I found the average price of gasoline in Arizona in 1995 was about 68 cents per gallon.
Holy moly. Wow. Yeah. I remember gas being under a dollar. Like when I drove.
Yeah. I was like, that's crazy. $7.18 won't even get you 2 gallons.
I know, you're still standing like, I think I might be able to get home on this.
Yes. And I low-key, want to throw up thinking about how inflated the prices are these days. That's so crazy. And it's also part of that, time capsule effect of her being like, I gave him a 20 for gas and he didn't give me my change. And I'm like, girl, you ain't getting no change.
I know. It's like calling somebody a 50 today and be like, exactly.
Yeah, I used it to fill the tank. What are you talking about?
Where am I chained?
Right. But Savannah is clearly annoyed by this man. He doesn't appear to have any redeeming qualities, but it's been 5 months since she's been intimate with someone. So again, he's there. He's available. So she is foregoing all those awful red flags to get what she wants out of him. And in another unsatisfying sex scene, Savannah just lays there as Lionel takes less than a minute to arrive to completion with growling noises.
This scene
her voiceover makes
up.
Fun of him.
Exactly. I let you do the beautiful line that she says, but, as uncomfortable as I was in the earlier scene with Robin and Michael and the comedic sex scene that is just as clumsy, somehow this one made me laugh. And the one with Robin, I couldn't. And I'm still trying to unpack. I don't know why. But when he starts growling, it's like, oh, my Lord, what?
Yes. Savannah makes fun of him. And she's like, oh, am I running a petting zoo now? Like, what?
He's like, I'm a zookeeper now? What did he say? I'm a keeper at the damn zoo.
Yes. That was ridiculous. It was a crazy scene.
And his teeth, I can't get out of as he's on all fours growling, and you just cheeses so much teeth while he's growling. I cannot get the teeth out of my head.
Oh, goodness. That's hilarious. Next up, in a quick scene, we're at John's office, and Bernadine enters a conference room that they are full on in a meeting, and she slaps John's mistress.
Wow. Come storming in a power suit. I do want to note her get up, which continues into the scene later, but looking sharp and fine, Bernie.
Yes. And she's like, oh, I looked at the bank account. John emptied the bank accounts. John's playing dirty. And I'm like, this is probably in response to her burning and selling his things.
Maybe. I'm like, did you do anything to bring this upon yourself, Bernie?
Yes.
Maybe.
Yes. But this scene is particularly intense. I feel a heightened sense of anxiety in this scene.
I feel like, contrary to other scenes, this scene is a little bit harder for Bernie. I don't feel like she maintained a lot of dignity. I think in other scenes where she's struggling and it's hard for her, she maintained a lot more dignity. And this scene, she just lost it all, barged in there, started smacking folk, and was, emotionally screaming at her husband. But she spoke her mind, and I believe it was quite gratifying for her. So, dignity or no dignity, she had to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think she's showing this different range of emotions that she's going through. There's the, I'm going to burn your car because I'm full of rage. I'm going to sell your stuff and I'm filled with glee. You took the money out of our account. What are we going to do? There's the panic.
Yeah, yeah.
Of it as well. And so we're experiencing these emotions with her. And this kind of begins the more contentious part of their separation. John tries to offer her $300,000, but Bernie is like, your kids are not for sale. Later on, we find out how much their mortgage is. That $300,000 wasn't going to last very long.
No. Yeah, exactly. Why was he tripping anyway?
Right. And so when John says that he's getting the kids on Saturday, Bernie is like, if you have my kids anywhere near their little trollop, you'll regret it. And
FYI.
So things are getting heated. Yes. And neither one of them is backing down. John, however, just there's something about his demeanor that's cruel. The fact that she can't really get a rise out of him.
Yeah, he's just cold. He's so beyond it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do love, though, when she storms in, John's new fling, Bernie's I don't know if she says anything or it's just a hand gesture, but, lady's out. She's just gone from the scene. It happened so quickly. She was like, oh, I gotta go. She's just gone. Yeah. And, the security guard's hovering around the door, and Bernie's you gonna call the security on me? And, he doesn't say anything. He just looks at the dude, and the security guy's like, I think I'm gonna peace out because this is about to heat up.
Yes. Yeah, she is almost a bull in a china shop.
Yeah.
That kind of energy. So in the next scene, we're at Gloria's house. Gloria goes to what appears to be a pool house or something, where she finds a grounded Tyreek receiving some oral gratification
this
from a young lady.
This scene is so funny. Mom opens the door and this little white girl pops her head up and he's like, oh, oh. And she just bolts out of there. It's just pure comedy.
Yes. And so Tyreek is like pulling his pants up and running after her and like apologizing. And while Gloria is upset and, you know, going on a rant, she accidentally reveals that Tyreek's father is gay.
Oh, Gloria, it slipped in such a non-elegant way. I was so disappointed.
Yes. And also, even what she said was crazy. Like, if your father wasn't gay, I'd send you straight to him. And I'm like, girl, what does him being gay have to do with it?
Yeah, what? It's nonsense. Yeah, nonsense.
Yeah. You might as well send him to a stranger. And worse, Tyreek actually uses the F word slur, which is like awful and has aged poorly and is clearly not appropriate these days. And Gloria even says, like, I don't like that word. Like,
yeah.
Don't use that word.
I was like, you let it slip. You like in the scene prior when Tyreek's father came out to her, I found her more confused and selfishly being like, oh, I guess that means we can't sleep together anymore. Like calculating that, I don't feel her connection with it. And here I see again her stumbling and I don't know how and if she's defending him in a way, but then saying more slanderous things, Tyreek's father. So I'm like, where are you landing on this whole issue?
Yeah, who knows? Tyreek is upset and says some things that like are like he wants to remove himself from being associated with his gay father. He's like, oh, it doesn't run in the family. Very homophobic. I mean, it is 1995, and I feel like this is more true to life and true to the environment in that time. Again,
and
like,
specifically, you know, I gotta call it specifically in the Black community.
Yes.
I remember being in high school, having some gay friends, and my brother, who was 3.5 years older, they would just crack jokes all the time. Like, liberally, for no reason. And I was like, why y'all gotta talk trash constantly? Like, do you even know gay people? Like, where is this even coming from? And so just the, you know, at that age group, you know, under 20 Black males, I think there was a lot of pressure to reject the homosexual anything or anything that wasn't just the tropes of heterosexual normative stuff that we see. So, yeah, a lot of very representative of the time. Yeah.
Yeah. Tyreek is 17 years old, so there's not a bunch of emotional maturity. He starts to scream out loud about his father's sexual identity. And, you know, a piece of this is like, okay, I'm learning this new fact about my father, a man who doesn't even care to really get to know me and puts the onus on me for us building a relationship. He has abandonment issues with his father. There's a bunch of things that are going on for him.
A lot came out. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And Tyreek has just been screwing up a lot lately. Like, girls at the house that his mom doesn't know about, his grade's not good. Like, Gloria's like, if I can't trust you here, how am I supposed to trust you in Spain? We learn later what that means. But yeah, their relationship, they're going through some stuff right now.
Yeah, it's a raging teenage. Son. Yeah, exactly. It's the teenage years and just Gloria's kind of claws and she's just lost, if you will, Tariq's father for once and for all. So she's dealing with a new situation, I would say, for herself as well, which, you know, brings some growth that we'll talk about later.
Yeah. So in the next scene, we're at Robin's job. It's a very brief scene, but she's doing a presentation with a printed graph. And I'm like, Lord Jesus, thank goodness for technology. Ain't nobody got time to be printing graphs.
Exactly. We sent it out 3 weeks ago to the printer. It should be back just in time for the board meeting.
Yes. And hopefully none of the numbers have changed. And,
exactly. Or like somebody made a typo.
Yes.
That's why I love clouding PowerPoints. It's like 30 seconds before we slap that up. Like I had to change a word.
Yes, but Michael, who was also in this meeting, the little chunky man that she was with earlier, is kind of being smug and kind of undermining what she's saying. And she, it's, you know, it's not very good. And she decides in that moment to stop messing with Michael. And we get an update on that later. We also see a brief scene where Bernie is at her divorce attorney's office and they review some financial documents to find that everything that John Sr. purchased in the last 10 years is only in his name. Her name isn't on anything.
Ugh, that is like an instructive. That is like the PSA, the public service announcement part of the film. Y'all make sure you put your name on stuff that you are owning, acquiring, or participating in any substantial way. Because they, you may think that is an accident, that it was only his name on that. That was not an accident.
Yes, yes. And part of this, there's some, very little, but some commentary on like the invisible labor of what it means to be like a stay-at-home mom or to be, you know, boots on the ground as the secretary of a startup company. This idea that even though your wife is sacrificing things because she's not necessarily being paid for these things, the value isn't obvious.
It's vapor. Yeah. And it's not captured or given a value to or, you know, compensated for. Super true.
And when you think about opportunity costs and like what she had to give up in order to be the background to his foreground, that's worth a lot of money. She has an MBA. She could have her own company. She could be doing her own thing. She has virtually no work history over the past 10 years. So it's not like she can go out here and get a job to support their current lifestyle. Being a stay-at-home mom means that your job is never over. You're working 24 hours a day. You wake up and go to sleep in your workplace. Like, there's a lot of labor that goes into doing those types of things. And the fact that she doesn't have her name on anything when she clearly enabled and helped him build to the point where he could get all these assets is crazy.
And I feel like that, again, just resonates outwards for thousands and thousands and thousands of women who were that background to somebody's foreground. So yeah, powerful stuff.
Yeah. But Bernie says, you know, I ain't trying to get rich. I just want to make sure I can take care, you know, of my kids. That's all for part one of this two-part episode. Head on over to wherever you listen to podcasts to hear part two. Thanks for listening to Sub Media Reviews. I hope you enjoyed our trip down memory lane just as much as I did. If you have any suggestions for movies or TV shows you'd like me to review next, or if you just want to share your thoughts on today's episode,
you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and Pinterest at Sub Media Reviews
and on submediareviews.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. And if you have a moment, please leave a review on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback helps me improve the show and spread the word to new listeners. So until next time, peace out, home slices.